Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you Living Labyrinths with Athena Dugan. Greetings and welcome, Athena. How are you tonight?
I am fine. How are you, Hercules?
I'm doing great and greatly looking forward to your show.
Great. Well, thank you all. So tonight I have, I'll be chatting with Katie Desjardins-Bull. And Katie is a parent mindfulness coordinator, a Labyrinth Society regional rep in California, the Los Angeles area, a trained Veritas Labyrinth facilitator, and teacher of evolutionary spirituality and contemplative practices. So welcome, Katie. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, Athena. How are you? I'm so glad to be here.
Good. Likewise, I'm glad that you could be here with us today. You have a really impressive and full plate of labyrinth work and a lot of spiritual work that you're doing for the labyrinth, and you have such a community of people that you're working with to bring this entire unit full circle.
Yeah.
So one thing that was interesting to me is there's a couple of things that I want to touch bases with you about. Is that the parent mindfulness coordinator? Now, was that something that stemmed out from the mindfulness movement, or is that something that's strictly, I don't know, a sister to mindfulness?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, it definitely comes out of the mindfulness movement. As a long-time practitioner of mindfulness, I was at a conference probably about 13 years ago where it was for educators, and I'm in the education world, and so I was there because I was really excited about it. It was held at the Omega Institute in New York, and it was just unbelievably fantastic, and there were so many educators there, and they were all from the Northeast Coast, basically, and I was coming from Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, I know. And so at the end of it, when everyone's doing popcorn style with ideas, someone said something, that just a quick popcorn, I'll get parents together. And I, for a long time, had been searching for something to bring parents together in our community that bridged sort of the spiritual world that we live in. And, you know, because we're quite an ecumenical, diverse community. And when they said a parent group, I mean, all the bells and whistles went off in my head, and I went, that's it, because you can talk about science of the mind and so forth. And
right.
Of course, parents love that, right? You know, if I can
right.
get my kids smarter, if I can make myself smarter or be a better parent. And so I approached it from that angle. And so we started about 12 years ago, and we really didn't know what we were doing. I was doing it with another gentleman in our school who was really into mindfulness. And it became clear that it was a thing that was of interest, and it was going to require a lot of work because we met weekly. That was our goal, was to meet every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. on campus. And that, for anyone that runs programs, you know that a weekly program and coming up with content and running meditation every week, it's a lot. So
yes.
we turned to hiring facilitators. And so I kind of became a coordinator of that movement. And now I still do that, and I do help other schools set it up and so forth. There's some interesting interest out there across our country, I'll say that.
Yeah, especially with now a lot of, is it a parent to student or is it just a parent alone practice?
The part that I'm involved with is just with the parents. And of course, there's the ripple effect of that to our children. But the school also does have mindfulness programs for the kids. So, but that is run separately.
Oh, wow. That's great. So you're the founder of not this movement, but the founder of the program for what you do, right?
Yeah, right. At the time, there was no other that we knew of. There wasn't a model we could follow. I had my MSW, and so as a social worker, you have a background in teaching a lot of social skills and so forth. So, and parenting skills, depending upon the population you're working with. And so it was just trying to piece all this together, the meditation and then the parent education piece, and not to mention the personal growth piece. Emotional piece. So it was just an amalgamation, and over the years, it's just grown and blossomed through the help of, I've got a great team that helps me, and we've had lots of spirals out of it. We now do labyrinth walks, and a lot of our people are now either they are meditation teachers or they are, you know, trying to become meditation teachers. They're in training. So it's really beautiful. To watch.
Wow, that's interesting to think of all the things that blossomed out of that, and especially the labyrinth. Now, how is it that the labyrinth spoke to you to evolve into part of your coordination? Like, how did that come about for you?
Oh God, that's a great story. So I had been into labyrinths for a very long time, probably about 35 years. And
oh my gosh.
And I kind of kept it close to the cuffs because I was in what at the time were probably more traditional circles. Not all of them, but some of them. And so then during COVID, when our parent mindfulness group was meeting every week, and we had pivoted to Zoom, and we didn't take any breaks because people really needed the connection. And so for holidays and summers, we continued to meet. And there was a big gap of content we needed to fill because we were doing it much more often than had been planned. And one day I just said to the group, I said, well, there is this thing I do. And they're like, what is that? And I said, it's called Labyrinth. And the whole screen just leaned in and went, what's that? And that alone right there, I mean, maybe not everybody, maybe somebody didn't quite do that, but that's what I saw in the moment. And so we began from there because there was such curiosity, holding walks, sort of quarterly walks. And we'd go to different labyrinths around Los Angeles. And of course I had people helping me with that as well. I have a parent who helps me coordinate it now. So that's kind of how that happened. And we are still going strong right now.
Oh wow, that's excellent. You know, and it evolved. So you had these team of people that have been helping you the whole time, and some of them, it was from your training that you brought them on your team, has it been a new group of people that have an interest in the labyrinth?
The people that came on to the lab to help me with the labyrinth were new to the labyrinth as well.
Oh, wow.
So after a time or two of walking, it was pretty clear to one woman, and her name was Dana, in particular, that I needed some help with coordinating everything. And so she stepped up. She said, I will do the email announcement, you know, keep track of who wants to go and where we're going and all that administrative part, and which I'm so thankful for. And then she and I, several times a year, will go out to a couple of new labyrinths around Los Angeles and document them, photograph, and put them up on, because we're building a network here of people interested in labyrinths, and we have a sort of a Facebook blog that it goes into. So we continue to learn and share it with others.
Wow. So what's the name of your blog so people can check it out, or what it contains, everything from your coordination to your or just the labyrinths that are in the Los Angeles area?
Right now it really is, it just contains the labyrinths in Los Angeles information. And I'll put on there, you know, World Labyrinth Day. And I posted the Today clip that was done with Lauren Artress at the Today Show, just to let people know that the labyrinth is alive and well out in the world. Right,
and, exactly.
Very much so.
So you trained as a labyrinth facilitator, and you've been into the labyrinth like for 35 years. So when you started out, like how easy was it to find labyrinths in your area? And it must have evolved like maybe quicker, I don't know, quicker than we thought. Because even in Philadelphia where I am, there's more labyrinths than I'm surprised to know. They're like, oh, you know, people will say to me, oh, yeah, there's a labyrinth at so-and-so, so-and-so. And then, you know, sometimes I'll go check it out, and I'm like, nah, that's a maze. You know, that's interesting that they would have a maze down. But, you know, it makes sense. You know, it's like some people think a labyrinth is a maze, and we know the difference. But how was it for you when you started, discovering the labyrinths or walking the labyrinths? Did you always find them in California, or were you more well-traveled in finding them in other locations?
Kind of all of the above. I initially I first came to them through a book my sister had called The Herman Man. It's sort of the Bible of labyrinths, which is a phenomenal book. And
what's the name of it again?
The name of it, something labyrinth, but it's a giant coffee table book, and it's written by Herman Mitt.
Oh, yes,
do you know
exactly. Yes, I do. That's a great.
Oh, you do? Very lucky. Yeah. Last time I went to buy it, it was $800. So I'm glad you must have gotten it before it skyrocketed.
Actually, I got it when for me, labyrinths were just beautiful things to look at. I had no idea that they were as big as they were. So,
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. Right. And that's kind of how it started for me, was just that curiosity of what is this? Why am I seeing this everywhere? Why were different cultures creating the same thing over and over again? And I was just trying to understand it almost from an archetypal standpoint. And I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico for many years, and my neighbor invited me on anthropological dig. She was a student at University of New Mexico in their program. And, of course, I'm like, of course I'm going to do that. And, you know, we go on this dig on private property, and there it is again. It just blew my mind that, the ancient people were drawing these in petroglyphs and so forth.
Wow.
And so that continued my path. And from there, I got married and we wound up actually in New Orleans, and I was part of a committee to bring a permanent labyrinth to our church school there, and heretical almost at the time, because that was a lot. That was probably 30 years ago.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
just love it. That's when I came to know Lauren Archis and François Legault, the canon of Chartres Cathedral in France, who came to speak, and just got immersed in the subject. And then through life, you know, moving and two children, and I always practiced it and did it and was a part of it for my own process. I would seek them out here in Los Angeles, but just privately. I did it by myself. And then I ended up, you know, with everything going online and kind of getting involved again. I can't even remember which came first. I think I became a regional rep. It was before COVID. So it's not that long ago.
Wow. Now, in the line of COVID and being a regional rep and a facilitator, how large was the demand for you, or how wide was the demand for you to create these walks? Because people were just even afraid to go out. I know that's what it seemed like in Philadelphia, even with the mask mandate. People were so frightened to go out and make that contact. That's what we couldn't do anyway. But how did that affect your transition from in-person walks to virtual walks?
You know, it's funny. COVID, if anything, enhanced the walk, because the group I was working with, this parent group I was working with, just wanted to be together. And so I was billing it, and I think so was Veritas and TLS, that it was a way that we could socially distance. We could, the labyrinth walks we went on were all outdoors. So we could socially distance, and we were able to do that work of going deeper as we were being called to, and it also solved that devastating problem of isolation that so many people were experiencing. So people really came out for it.
Wow, that's so the opposite here. I guess it varied per state, yeah. Huh. So I know here in Philadelphia, it was taboo. It was not going to happen. You know, no one's going to be within, I would say, 10 feet of a person. Although, you know, of course, as it got better, it was easier. And then I think even when I did my first outdoors walk, it was, when was that? Well, I know it was a healing, a global healing walk. So I was like, okay, so this works. And I was surprised that we had so many people that had come out. You know, I did get nervous, but I'm like, well, we're outdoors, it's safe, and you know, and that's actually after the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I would imagine in Philadelphia, your climate's a little different than ours. We could pretty much go out, at least during COVID. We didn't have the bomb rain cyclones that came through. But our weather was made it more accessible.
All right.
Wow. Year-round.
Yeah. So you're doing a lot of labyrinth finding in your area as a regional rep. You're finding more and more labyrinths. Is this something that's happening? Are you involved in creating some of these labyrinths, or is it just something that, like I say, that you're discovering as time goes on?
Yeah, actually, I just took the TLS labyrinth locator and did a 25-mile radius around Los Angeles and came up with approximately 42.
Wow.
Right. And but that includes Canvas. And so from there, we just started visiting and, Los Angeles is this huge metropolitan area. And
yes.
So we would take areas of the city and focus on labyrinths in those areas of the city each time we'd go. But what we found, actually, at least the feeling is a lot of these labyrinths had been around a while. So back in the day when they first came to the United States, when Lauren Artress made it popular here in the 90s, so that they were probably of a lot of them built around the 90s. And then I think it went, I don't want to say dormant, but the AIDS crisis was behind us. And, it's in those times of need that it has really come out. And so we were just resurfacing many of them that are here. Not that all of them were dormant. That's not true. But many have been. And we still have many left to see. So we'll find out.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So there was one that you actually found in Culver City, right? What was it called? The nature?
Oh, the stone.
No, the Tree of Life Labyrinth, right?
Right, the Tree of Life Stone View in the Culver City area. That's right.
Yeah. Wow.
It was put in by the state parks. Or the Forest Service. Yeah, no, it's run by the state park, and an artist was commissioned to come and build it, and she's still very active with that labyrinth. And
oh wow,
you can, it's interesting because when you get there, you can see it from a drone shot, but you can't see the enormity of the whole thing
right.
when you're there. If you don't know what you're looking at, you can see the central part of the labyrinth, the classical pattern that it's built around. But the
wow.
rest of it, you really see it more in that drone shot. It's very cool.
Well, I tell you, the labyrinth, it's so funny how it came to me. I've been to all these places, and I might have even met you in New Mexico had I gone to visit my sister when she was there. But I've been to San Francisco. I didn't go to the cathedral. I had an opportunity to go to France, never went to Chartres. Oh, gosh. And even when I was in Culver City, I had no idea that a labyrinth was so close to where I was staying. So, wow.
Oh, when were you there? Because I don't think it's that old.
No, I was there like in, I want to say like in the, let's see, in the 90s. Yeah.
Oh,
was it in the 90s? No, 90s or 1,000, 2,000. Huh. Well, anyway, I know I was there, like, and I wasn't actually into the labyrinths, but like I said, I saw it as a beautiful, creative design that I had no idea that it could be walked until I had my own spiritual experience with a full-size one at a spiritual retreat, which was... unbelievable.
Yeah.
So
kind of draws you in, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. And that's the thing about the labyrinth that I love. And to me, it almost feels like, you know, how, what was that? Close Encounters of the First Kind. I kept drawing labyrinths and I'm like, I got to walk these. So really
great.
Interesting. So, Yeah.
I've
so
heard
how
of
often?
People.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I want to hear what
say,
you.
I've just heard of people similar to you that draw this pattern out and don't even know about what the labyrinth is. They're just, you know, it's in our DNA. It's part of life. It's part of evolution. And so it makes sense. It's in everything we see almost when you take it under a microscope. And,
right.
Or bigger mega patterns, you know. In the atmospheric flows and so forth, we see it really everywhere. So it's in our psyches, it's archetypal. So
yes, exactly.
It doesn't surprise me. Yeah,
that's it's just so interesting that how the labyrinth just speaks to us and how it just is part of our, like you say, is part of our DNA. And I had Jan Salt on here at one point talking about how someone said the labyrinth was imprinted as part of her DNA. So it just sort of makes natural sense. And it, when you think about how that all ties in with sacred geometry and all the natural mm-hmm. rhythms of the earth and stuff, it just makes sense. You know, the labyrinth is an earth. I call it an earth deity because we're walking upon it. We're walking upon Earth Mother. We're walking upon this design that, you know, it definitely creates a conscious shift. So it's just amazing.
It's to me, I once had a dream that there was a key, and the key was a labyrinth. So just imagine where you press it into the candle wax, that it would be a labyrinth, and that that being from another plane could come down, and it was that point at which they could access us, you know, access the earth. And they're known to, you know, be put in spots where it can heal the earth.
Yeah.
There's a story about a labyrinth, actually in Sedona, that was painted on a parking lot and very much used, a very beloved painted parking lot labyrinth, that it was walked so much, the pattern of the human impacting the labyrinth, impacting the earth, that it opened up an unknown stream of water that flowed under the, and in Sedona that seems almost impossible because it's so, you know, it's so dry underneath the parking lot. So these things are powerful.
Yes. Yeah, it's almost like, it reminds me of, like, you know, they say if you pray to a certain deity or you pray like for a certain energy that's maybe dormant, you can actually bring it to life. So that's
right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's kind of what's been happening with the labyrinth. Exactly.
Yes. Wow. So do you yourself, do you get to walk the labyrinth all the time? Well, more than once, at least a week. Or how often do you get to walk the labyrinth?
You know, it's funny. After becoming a facilitator, I mean, I definitely walk when I'm facilitating. But I now am the proud owner of a 36-foot canvas and an 18-foot. So it's a 36-foot chakra style. And then I have an 18-foot processional, which is
Of
a little personal labyrinth. And I'll pull that one out, worse, you know, push comes to shove if I can't get to a labyrinth. There aren't any super close to where I live in Los Angeles. So that is something I want to try to rectify and find a way to get one built in our local area.
Oh, that's great. Are you having any success, or is the contact, are they local? I mean, are you able to get in contact with your local park, or how does that work for you?
You know, right now I've mostly been focused on the raising awareness of it, you know, and teaching people about and bringing, creating community around it, because it didn't exist in a broader sense here. There might be a church or two that can be pretty regular with it, but outside of them just being there and people using them for their personal practice, maybe showing up, there is a retreat center near here that does hold quarterly walks, you know, around the equinox and so forth. But it is on a canvas, and canvases are great. I there's nothing wrong with a canvas labyrinth. So
yes.
I was just going to say, to kind of continue on that question of, do I get to walk a personal labyrinth? A lot of it has been around travel too. So destination labyrinth travel. So most recently, Peggy and I, my sister, who's a labyrinth facilitator, a trained Veriditas facilitator, went to Chatra, which was great, right before Christmas. And then, of course, there's been the trips to Chatra in France a couple of times.
Yes.
And just wherever I go, you know, I think like most people who are into labyrinths, they're doing the same thing, kind of on this quest, right?
Yeah.
Anywhere.
Yes.
Kind of like having college-age children or near college-age children, and every trip you take, you're off visiting colleges, you know, every vacation becomes about a college trip. I hate to say it.
I can imagine. So do you and your sister, Peggy, do you work together when you're doing labyrinth events?
Well, she lives in a place called Covington, Louisiana, across the lake from New Orleans. And so we collaborate, we talk about, we share, you know, materials, we like I said, we just did this walk. We met in Arizona for gathering together in October. When I lived in the New Orleans area, yes, we would definitely walk together. So we we had my 36-foot one out in the front yard over Christmas. She was here. It didn't fit, but we tried. We did a center of the labyrinth process, you know, kind of had it partially open.
Right.
But she taught me how to really care for a canvas labyrinth and the sweeping of it. And we had a bunch of us folding it up together. It was much more than I realized, laying out and picking up a labyrinth. It's not a one-man job at all.
No.
No, you know. Sounds like you know.
Yeah. I don't have a canvas, but I've seen it done, and I'm like, ooh, not one person can do that, you know, because I'm just like, oh, I'll lay down my whole labyrinth. I'll make my whole labyrinth, lay it down and everything, you know, with my materials, but I could do that, you know, by myself, or I could have some assistance. It's always fun with more people, but to lay down a canvas one now, especially, you know, at 36 foot or bigger, there's just no way. It's not a one-man job.
Yeah. No, and it's a ritual. It's a ritual. You know, you're opening sacred space, and
exactly,
you want to share that, you know, with others.
I love that. I love the idea you said that your labyrinth was too big, so you just had the center of the labyrinth available, which I think is definitely something that a trained labyrinth facilitator can facilitate, that type of walk, and people will still get an amazing experience. And that is I've noticed that when I do a labyrinth, I watch how people walk it. If they, you know, I give them my, you know, facilitator suggestion, you know, give them the spiel, and then watch how they approach the labyrinth. And if some of them, like, are people that just are too in their own minds to, like, even listen to what I'm saying, they'll just go right to the labyrinth, and some will walk right to the center. And it's interesting mm-hmm. to see how people relate to the labyrinth. Or I guess that might be the way it speaks to them, or what they may feel, what they need. But it's just interesting yeah. that you had people go, you worked from the center of it. And what, when you did that, was it a different process for you, or did you notice, like, anything different from your normal full circuit, you know, facilitation?
Well, first of all, what I find is when I give the talk, you know, the whole talk, and part of the talk includes, I'm usually working with a chakra medieval style with the petals. Mm-hmm. So, and I will always explain the petals. I know there's many, many different ways to explain the petals. I'll usually do one of two ways. And people are so drawn to these concepts, this idea, that I find, yes, you know, we're doing they'll do the release, and, you know, the intention, the release, and then during the receive, there just seems to be almost this beeline to the center. And so when I had it just the center opened in the front yard, and kind of gave the spiel, and then, you know, we began the center process, people really take it to heart what you can, wow. what the, some of these processes you can do. And when you say minerals, you know, you're going sort of through the evolution or creation cycle of minerals, plants, animals, to humans, to the angelic, to the unknown. And I think people hear, like, in what you need in your life and what you, you know, what, you know, you've come for, they're jumping over each other to get to that angelic and that human and that, and sometimes it's to the animal, you know, if they have a suffering pet or a beloved pet that passed or something. But or a lot of people love going into the unknown because, and I know, you know, the processes they're undergoing, because they're trying often to find answers to, you know, what to do next in life. And it just, it brings, it crystallizes the process to talk about this. You know, it's more than receive, but it's receive, we can receive specifically. So it's kind of cool. One time, long time ago, when I was trying to create a Magdalene and Labyrinth community here in Los Angeles, when I first moved here about 20 years ago, the only people I could find to invite, I mean, I had friends that were helping me from Sedona and from San Francisco who flew in to help me, but local people is where I was running into a little bit of, I just didn't know enough people back then, but I was finding the authors who lived here, which was interesting. And so one of the authors who came offered, it was just really exciting. And we had Judy Massey, my friend, who was my mentor on the labyrinth. God, she is in hospice right now. She is in the veil, so we are with her in spirit right now. But Judy was one of the people who came, and she took a tablecloth, a round tablecloth, and, well, actually it was my idea, but she did the work, and she painted the center in the round tablecloth, and we each, everybody that attended the retreat, each got a center of the labyrinth, And then we had laid out her 28-foot labyrinth in my backyard, and then we put our labyrinth on top of the labyrinth and did the circle of the labyrinth process with her name is Kathleen McGowan, who lived here and came to the retreat. But she ended up leading. It was just so spur of the moment. She led that, and it was fantastic.
Wow.
There's a lot you can do with the center to answer that question.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the center is the meat of the labyrinth, right? After you get through all the mundane and your thoughts and everything, you get to that center. It's such the meat.
Mm-hmm. That's where we're supposed to let it fall away, you know, working through our ego, working through whatever is an obstacle coming up and trying to release. I mean, I know this is a lifetime of work, but it's cumulative. You know, we can step back into it from where we were and grow from that point, from the last point. And so this beautiful cumulative opportunity is at our fingertips. And
this is true.
Anyhow.
Yeah. So you are a teacher of evolutionary spirituality. Now, exactly. What is that? Tell me a little bit more about it, because it sounds really interesting. And is it more religious? Or I'll let you tell me some more, and I'll follow.
Sure. No, I'm happy to talk about it. Yes. It's a pretty complicated topic, and I, you know, to simplify it, in some ways, that's who it's for. It's for the spiritual but non-religious. So a lot of people who have lost hope in their church, you know, they've seen the inconsistencies, you know, over, and not all churches. I don't mean to paint the broad stroke, but they don't want to throw out, you know, the baby with the bathwater, or maybe they do. You know, it's people that have been spiritual, and a lot of them tend to come from some sort of religious background. It could be Buddhism, it could be Judaism, it could be Christianity, Hinduism, but they've seen, you know, they've had the scales peeled, they've seen, and it just hasn't been a good fit of late. But they want to be connected to a spiritual path. And so it really opens the ears and eyes of so many people when they begin to learn a little bit about what it is. Yeah. So it doesn't have those kind of religious boundaries. And it isn't a religion. A lot of people want to say it's a religion, but it is not a religion. It's more of a container. It's more of a structure, if you will, in the good sense of the word, a way to become spiritual or move in your spiritual process wherever you are. It's, you know, that some of the premises, or maybe I should back up and say where it came from. I mean, there are some fathers, as it turns out, it's a male, that it came out of. K.R. Desjardins is one of the major people who brought it forth in the 40s and 50s, 1940s and 50s. His work was built upon the work of Aurobindo, and today people working on it, like I said, in many different faiths are coming to this, because when you think about it, where are religions, or why are religions were developed in the first place, was there was all this spiritual information coming from different places, and it had to be made into something so that people could follow. But then that got off course in many cases. And I'm a woman of source material. I really like going back to source material. And so for me, when I learned that there was a whole other part, you know, like when the Nag Hammadi surfaced in the deserts of Egypt, and the Dead Sea Scroll from, you know, the Mount Sinai area surfaced, and the fact that they were kept from us in some ways, or they were being told to burn them back in the fourth century, third and fourth centuries, all my hairs and, you know, ears stand on end, because that's the stuff I want to know. I want to know the stuff that they didn't want us to know. And if that makes sense. So,
no, yeah, I totally understand.
Right.
It almost, it's not a mystery religion, but there is, you shine a light on that, those mysteries they don't want you to know about.
Right. I mean, evolutionary spirituality doesn't in and of itself do that. That's not its purpose. It's just part of the complexion of what might be going out there for people that are drawn to it, you know, that might be a reason that they left. Or like in my case, I do both, you know, I dabble and I keep my foot in many doors. So,
right.
Because there's good in all. There's good in all. There's definitely good in all, and good people, you know. So,
yeah.
But when I first learned about evolutionary spirituality, it was through a woman. Her name is Ilio Delio, is her name. And she happens to be a Catholic nun, but she is radical. And she was a biologist before she became a nun, just as Bayard was a paleontologist, as well as a Jesuit acolyte. He wasn't a full priest, but he was very much under the influence of the Jesuits, who, you know, who questioned many things.
Yeah.
But there are premises on which evolutionary spirituality, you know, beliefs and so forth, and it's things such as we are all connected, right?
Right.
We are connected,
right, yeah,
to the animals, to the earth, to the, you know, we are, you know, it's earth-based in that sense. Teilhard believed in that there was this, he called it the noosphere, and, you know, the noosphere was sort of this biosphere of higher knowledge, at least at the time. He didn't know the internet or Zoom or any of this when he was writing about this, but he imagined the day that this overarching noosphere would exist. Evolutionary spirituality very much believes that, as well as that, we grow through our obstacles and through our difficulties, that we evolve. That's how, that's where mankind came from. That's how our spinal column went from being horizontal to vertical. You know, something happened that made us have to stand up, and, you know, over millions of years, but maybe to run faster. You know, we don't know what it was.
Right, exactly.
And that we have to do our shadow work, that we have to do our work. You know, that is part of becoming a clear vessel, so that we can self-reflect, and that consciousness self-reflects and can grow. So, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just wondering, because it's really interesting. So is this something you're developing, a program, a labyrinth program, or retreats that have to do with the evolutionary spirituality that you're teaching? Is that right? Or you're working with it in that sense, working with the labyrinth?
Well, it's kind of, the labyrinth is an evolutionary symbol. If you think about it, you think of the beautiful photographs you see of the fern just beginning to unfold uncoiled. Yes, exactly. You know, there's the spiral, right? It's all
yes,
over
exactly.
the place. So the labyrinth gets to be in that category as well. And it also comes to it, a lot of what evolutionary and doing our shadow work, we're turning to contemplative practices. We're turning to self-reflection to help rid us of, ideally, you know, the bad parts of our ego self and other things. And so when teaching evolutionary spirituality, doing a contemplative practice is a part of it. And so we offered a 6-week program one time, and then we offered a 7-week another time, and each week we would have a different contemplative practice is half of the class. So the first hour or so was learning about the topic of the day, and then we would second half we would learn a new contemplative practice and then practice it. And so what I've been developing now is just taking all the contemplative practices that I teach and developing retreats around that.
Oh, wow. That sounds complex, but it's really interesting because it's not a religion. It's more of a practice. Is that what some of them call themselves? An evolutionary spiritualist?
That is a really interesting way of thinking about it. It involves the practice. That is how we evolve. That is by getting clear, cleaning up our act, and being more available to do work in the world, and being there for others, and being capable of greater love and all those things. So,
right.
So that is a part of it. That's interesting,
okay.
A practice. It's more of a philosophy, but involves
philosophy.
Heavy practice, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I get a philosophy. Yeah, so it's more of a philosophy, right, which is a way of life. So like you're connecting with nature, you're connecting with everything, the world around you, but it's not necessarily, you don't say this connection is God or this, it just is.
It is whatever it is for that person. So, you know, finding that God
okay.
within, following that
right.
that divine within. But it's still used in churches that, you know, believe one and the same. So we need
right.
both. We need that instruction from the greater world, and then we need it from within, you know. But definitely
right.
the path within has to come first. But there's one other principle that I didn't talk about evolutionary spirituality, and that it very much relies on cooperation, collaboration. They say diversity is our superpower. So that's not, that can be a practice, but it's also a philosophy,
mm-hmm.
if that makes
right.
sense.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, it does, a philosophy. I like that a lot. I think how religion is evolving. Now I think this could be like the perfect practice. It's more of a philosophy that you believe in that still gives you that grounding and that clarity of spirit, right? Of being fine with yourself
yeah.
and being able to integrate yourself into life and even with, I guess, other practices without feeling lost.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it too. Right, but again, there are a lot of people involved in evolutionary spirituality as well
mm-hmm.
as the labyrinth, as well as contemplative practices, this whole realm that
right.
still go to church, but then they have their, you know, daily practice. So,
right.
you know, I think people more and more have daily practices. You know, I feel like we are speeding up because more and more people are meditating or whatever their more, you know, their practice is, contemplative
right.
practice is, and getting clearer and opening themselves up more to the world. And I just feel like it's just speeding us all up in a sense. Toward what end? I don't know.
None of us know.
Right. I love the idea, though, of being spiritual, you know, and that could be a philosophy on its own. So that's wonderful.
We have four minutes left, Athena.
Oh, my God. Okay. Oh, my gosh. Okay. We could talk about this some more, but we're down to the wire. We have 4 minutes left. So, Katie, I want you to give me as much information as you can. Will people can get involved with one of your walks? How can they contact you? And since you're teaching this evolutionary spirituality, I would love people to be able to connect with you on that end. So please tell me, where can people connect with you? What's your you can, if you want to give us your email or definitely your social media handles where they can contact you.
Sure, I'd be happy to. For Labyrinth Walks around Los Angeles, their Facebook is called, it's a group, and it's called Labyrinth of Los Angeles, and you have to write the whole thing out, Labyrinth of Los Angeles Region and More, because we do go to the periphery of Los Angeles, and you should be able to find some things there. For evolutionary spirituality, we've been teaching it through a retreat center in Encino called Holy Spirit Retreat Center. And I'm happy to give my email out. I also have a website. My Instagram is my name, Katie Desjardins Bull. And that's the same as my Facebook, so those are all the same. Katie Desjardins Bull, Desjardins Bull. And my website is contemplativeexperiences.com. It's not very active right now, but it's just an internet presence, if you will.
Right.
And my email is my last name, Desjardins.Katherine, Katherine, @gmail.com.
Great. Wow, this is wonderful. And you'll have to come back. Eventually, I want to have everyone come back and maybe be in a nice round circle talking about the labyrinth and the experiences and everything, because they're so variable. And I just want to thank you for being here tonight and talking with us about your experience and your programs that you're creating and that you're bringing to the communities. And I host a Labyrinth Walk myself once a month online.
Oh,
and
great.
It's at, you could go to Philadelphia Meetup at, what do I call them? Labyrinth. Philadelphia Labyrinth Walk. Okay, so I want to thank everybody, and thank you so much, Katie. And I'll talk to you really soon, and thank you for listening to Liberating Labyrinths, and we'll talk to you all soon. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you, Athena. You're a great interviewer, so I appreciate the time and the interest, and I can't wait to come back. Okay.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you, Hercules.
Talk soon.
Bye for now.
Thank you, Hercules.
Thank you, Athena.
Bye.
Thank you, Katie.
Bye,
take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye.